She's the author of a book on the postmodern novel called Chronoschisms, Time, Narrative, and Postmodernism, which came out with Cambridge University Press. And among her many articles, she's published a short and a very handy introduction to eco-criticism, for those of you wondering what it is, which is fittingly called The Hitchhiker's Guide to Eco-Criticism, which came out in the PMLA in 2006. And it's an article I highly recommend. And I also highly recommend her recent book, which is called A Sense of Place and Sense of Planet, The Environmental Imagination of the Global, which just came out from Oxford University Press last year. Professor Heise's recent book stages a dialogue between the dominant forms of eco-criticism, particularly the place-based aesthetic, as it's been formulated by scholars, particularly in the American West, alongside theories of globalization and cosmopolitanism, which, generally speaking, have been suspicious of models of extreme localism. As such, she's encouraging us to think critically about the way some eco-critics depict localism as an inherently progressive politics, without considering how national discourses of belonging and attachment to place have often pathologized migration and cultural difference. Heise's work brings together these two models by theorizing how a sense of place can mean such a radically different thing to different groups. Her book makes a provocative argument to replace the discourse of eco-localism with an eco-cosmopolitanism in order to uphold a more dynamic and fluid model of environmental world citizenship. The title of her talk today is No Talk of Trees, Environmental Literature and the Question of Global Cultural Difference. Please join me in welcoming Professor Ursula Heise.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and to be part of this series. So as you can see from my title, I took the topic of this lecture series somewhat seriously to investigate the ways in which environmental thought does hang together with different cultural backgrounds. And what I'm interested in is the question of how different cultural and literary traditions conditions or informs of thinking about the environment and about ecology, indeed, as a scientific discipline, and then by extension lead to very different types of environmentalist movements and to different types of environmentalist literature. And so as you can see from the handout, my focus is going to be on the U.S. and Germany, and I'll say more in a minute as to what I'm going to do here. Let me start out by giving a little bit of a general background in terms of how I see eco-criticism having engaged or and not engaged with questions of culture and cultural difference. And then I'll give you a very, very sort of quick historical survey of the environmentalist movement in Germany and how it differs from the American environmentalist movement. And then we're going to move into the meat of environmental literature, in this case, particularly poetry, and how it, in some ways, is symptomatic of some of these differences. So as you probably all know, when eco-criticism emerged in the early 1990s, it was firmly rooted in one national culture, namely that of the United States, and attained its first intellectual visibility mostly in American studies and was, in fact, constituted from within the Western Literature Association. At the same time, the work of the first generation of eco-critics situated itself in staunch and very vocal opposition to, at the time, prevailing post-structuralist theories of literature. The perception was that the emphasis of post-structuralism on textuality, social construction of biological concepts, was a major obstacle to addressing issues of environmental pollution, demographic growth, consumption, species extinction, or climate change, and I think that perception was not entirely unjustified. Given the emphasis on the urgency of real-life ecological issues and on the necessity of political awareness and intervention, it's unsurprising that a great number of first-wave eco-critics focused on nature writing in the form of nonfiction prose. And indeed, you could argue that one of the major achievements of that first wave of eco-criticism was to open up that entire new archive in American literature to study in a way that it had been before. Now, a little more surprisingly, poetry also played a really central role in the eco-critical engagement with literature at a time when poetry was not a dominant genre in literary studies in the late 80s and early 90s. And that in spite of the fact that poetry would seem at first blush to lend itself less readily to any kind of straightforward realist approach to environmentalist issues. Now, first wave eco-criticism, as I see it, got around that issue to some extent by focusing for the most part on not particularly experimental kinds of verse, fairly transparent forms of free verse by authors who have, most of them, a known commitment to environmentalist issues. So Wendell Berry, Gary Snyder, W.S. Merwin, Robinson Jeffers, Mary Oliver, and so forth. And at the same time, they eschewed and indeed attacked poetry and poetry criticism that engaged above all issues of textuality. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with Leonard Skigai's book, Sustainable Poetry, from 1999, but he argues very vigorously for a renewed engagement with the real world outside the text, a poetry based on what he calls référence, sort of in a play on the French différence. And it's a book that's very vocal in its celebration of poetry that very resolutely centers on the material world, as well as in its dismissal of post-structuralism and any kind of language-oriented poetry. Now, Skigai, like quite a few other critics, invokes the European phenomenological tradition of Heidegger and Merleau-Ponty as a way of thinking about the human encounter with nature. But, as you might anticipate, his understanding of that tradition differs substantially from that of Derrida and other post-structuralists. What interests Skigai and other eco-critics in that phase of the area is the, mostly the Heideggerian critique of modern society and technology and the emphasis on authentic dwelling, understood as reconnection with an essential human self as well as with the fundamental structures of nature. So in that view, the way in which poetry is understood is as a mode of resistance to the distortions of authentic being brought about by modernist rationality. So that's sort of first wave eco-criticism. All of these initial eco-critical assumptions about the natural world, about its scientific exploration, about the nature of representation, and the centrality of realism were gradually put into question after the turn of the millennium. On one hand, you have critics like David Maisel, who in his book American Literary Environmentalism takes a very different kind of approach to the history of American environmental movement, environmental literature that's really based on Michel Foucault and Judith Butler in large part. And then on the other hand, you have critics such as Dana Phillips, who are more science-oriented. And Dana Phillips's Truth of Ecology from 2003 attacked above all what he perceived as the all-too-simple and ultimately inaccurate understanding of contemporary ecological science and eco-criticism. But so on one hand, you have increasingly controversial debates raging in the eco-critical arena after the turn of the millennium, and a much greater variety of theoretical perspectives, as well as a vastly expanded literary canon. And by now, that canon ranges across all continents and a variety of languages. Nevertheless, when you look at work in eco-criticism, I think it does remain striking how much of this work, especially but not only on poetry, continues to revolve in terms of the topics it engages around basic modalities of human embodiedness, human cognition and perception, and how those might translate into text. By contrast, differences in the understanding of nature that emerge not from underlying biological, cognitive, and social dimensions of humans' interaction with the natural world, but from the contingencies of vastly differing regional, national, and subnational cultures and histories are much more rarely investigated. So on one hand, you have these huge sort of cultural schemas of difference by William Mills, Neil Everender, and Carolyn Merchant, where critics try to categorize different cultural approaches to nature by huge historical periods, sort of antiquity, Middle Ages, Renaissance. And whenever you try to use those in the engagement of literary texts, it's really difficult to do because, of course, the literary texts often do not line up with the great epistemes of the periods, if one even believes these epistemes. I mean, they're as often, I think, unconvincing as generalizations as they're persuasive. One of the more, I think, interesting developments in this area has been the rise of the post-colonial paradigm in eco-criticism, which has recently arisen and is in the process of rising currently. In the work that's been published to date, though, I don't think that this gap in engagement with culture has yet been filled. While postcolonial eco-critics do eloquently point to the differences that geopolitical and socioeconomic inequalities make for claims about human relation to nature.